This is Phil Farron, and I am driving home. It's Thursday today. It's actually a little bit early Thursday today. We had this mad rush coming up to the 1st of November. Everything just sort of triangulated together, and I had three projects simultaneous. All had either hard deadlines, well, somewhat hard deadlines on November 1st, or really, really desired deadlines on November 1st. And so I worked a lot of hours over last month getting things ready and getting them to line to where we'd be ready to go. And we got close on most of them. And on some of them, came in right on time and everything was fine. But the project that was supposed to pick up in November, which is still in process, still, you know, on the boilerplate, there's just a few more clearances that have to happen through the executive staff. And so I've got a little bit of breathing room here. And so I finished up on some things today and I was pretty much out of work, so. And yesterday, I actually sat and talked politics with some of the programmers for an half hour. I just went off the clock and chatted with them, which we'll get back to in a minute. So it's like 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and I am going home. I have a few things that I'm going to work on this evening. I actually have an idea for some Christmas presents, and so gonna go home and work on that. In other news, I uploaded yesterday the files for the third book on Grumpy Old Prophets, and just ordered the proof copies for that today, as well as a second proof for the second book, Wanting and Waiting. So they should be coming in next week. Hopefully there aren't too many changes I'm gonna make after that, and if so, that means I've got all three books, first three books up, and then I'm just going to be waiting for input to come back from the beta readers on the last book, Acting, and that should, it's supposed to be coming in on the 17th, this is the 8th, so it's supposed to be coming in the end of next week, so I will be right on target for that, and I can in fact get started early with the few people who have already written me with corrections and get those corrections made, and I have figured out that I really do need to take the last chapter, which is 20 pages long. Normally the chapters run around 10, average around 10. I've got one. The last chapter, I was trying to say a lot, and I was trying to say it all in one chapter, and it ended up being 20 pages long, and I was like, okay. I already had one beta reader say, man, that last chapter is really long, so I've got to break that up, I know, and then it'll be interesting to see what the rest of the reaction is. I was talking to my daughter earlier this week, and she's reading through it, and I said, so, what do you think? I said, what'd you think about Ananias and Sapphira? And she said, well, I read it. She said, before I say anything, I'd like Alan, my son-in-law, to read it, and I'm going to ask him, so, what'd you think about that? So, we'll see. I was thinking this week, after I had talked to her, a normal person, would probably, oh, I forgot. I have to get a movie. Maybe two. Oh. See, because I'm going home to do some graphics work, and it's nice to have a movie playing in the background, and I haven't seen Prometheus yet. And Prometheus is not the kind of movie that my wife is going to watch anyways, and my son-in-law and I are going in different directions at this point. And so it's kind of hard to get together for like a 2-hour block, just us. So maybe I'll check a red box up here in the corner and just see if perchance they have Prometheus. Yeah. So I'm going to have to hop out of the car for a minute, but I'm not going to do that thing I did yesterday or last week where I'm not recording this on my phone in case you can't tell any difference with the audio quality. But we're just going to stop it, and then I'll be right back. Anyways, so if I was a normal person, what I would have done with this series is I would have written the first book on the Christmas story. I would have written the second book on the life of Christ. And then I would have written the third book on Easter, called it a trilogy, and called it done. Just by expanding the third book a little bit, I could have put it in a couple of resurrection scenes and put a little epilogue in, and everyone went out and they were happy because Jesus was alive. I could have done that. But of course, with me, I can't leave well enough alone. So instead of doing all that, I have to write another book, Acting, in which I basically take on a bunch of the sacred cows in Christianity. And my daughter tried to tell me, as when I'm writing this book, she goes, you know, some people, they really think like the early church. She didn't say this, but to put words in her mouth, the early church was like all that in a bag of chips. And if you start writing about how they went off the rails so quickly, there's going to be some people who don't really like that. You know me, I never one to leave well enough alone. I just go ahead and write the book. Of course, now that I've written the book, I can't very well not put the book out. So I think probably what's going to happen with this one is I have some beta readers who have, you know, been very effusive about the early books, how much they love them, gives them goosebumps, how they cried at the end, all this kind of stuff. Very effusive they've been regarding these books. Then they're going to get to Acting, and they're going to be reading into Acting, and you go, wait a minute. And I'm basically just going to leave them with a sour taste in their mouth. But maybe they will have already talked to other people about the books before they get to Acting. So maybe it'll still be okay. And who knows? Maybe if it's a little controversial, they'll talk about it with their friends and think about it. I did have one friend who has finished the book already. And he told me that he really enjoyed the book. And he said it, you know, that a lot of the things that I talked about in the book, he said, I've thought about those for years. He said, I think I already felt that way. And he said, I just, you know, even, he said, I look back, and even when he was in his teen years, and even, you know, young, well, not young, but early teen years, you know, he said he always kind of felt like there was just something about just going to church and sitting there that it just wasn't satisfying to him. And so it's interesting. It's just going to be really interesting. The only thing I'm even partially concerned with at this point is that the other three books have pretty good quotes on the back. I mean, there's like four quotes a piece on the back, and they're pretty good quotes about how much people enjoyed the book. And I'm a little bit concerned that on this next one, I'm not going to have any quotes from the back. So anyways, okay, I have to go get a couple of movies. Be back in a minute. Okay, so I'm back. Make the car started here again. Can't ever do the normal thing or the thing that's commercially viable. Kind of reminds me of a band that I heard about at one point. These guys, they weren't very successful in their band, because they said our philosophy was we would play songs and cover songs and stuff, and as soon as we'd see anyone in the audience starting to sing along with us, we'd just switch to another song because we weren't going to have any of that. So that's sometimes the way I end up doing things. I do have a big decision to make coming up, because as soon as I get this last book uploaded and released, then the question is really what comes next. And I've been thinking about that, and I'm going to be thinking about it long and hard, because at this point I do have a readership that is of a certain demographic that are very enthusiastic, and I'm really not sure it would be wise to walk away from that. And I have a series that would still fit with that demographic, Amanda and the Skleeberry Tree, that I could finish up. Or I could go get started with Realmers, which is the 24-book series. But it's hardcore science fiction and much more gritty. So I'm thinking about that. Anyways, I had mentioned earlier that yesterday I had run myself out of things to do, and it was lunchtime, and I knew the web programmers were in their war room over there, their bullpen over there, where they all work together in one big room. And I knew they were probably eating lunch. And so, given that it was Wednesday, the day after the big election, I thought I should just wander over there, because I could hear them kind of just talking. I couldn't hear what they were saying, but I had a pretty good idea what they were talking about. So I wandered over and flopped down on their couch and just listened for a few minutes. And of course, sure enough, someone says, well, what do you think about, you know, it's very interesting. Politics. Very interesting. Several years ago, I started trying to make an effort to break out of my own tribalistic mindset when it came to politics, and to really attempt to see things in a more cross-cultural way. And I am now to the point where I'm willing to be a little bit obnoxious about it. I had mentioned several weeks ago that I had a vibrant discussion with my cousin on politics and other things. And what started it out was, he asked me, did you watch the debates? And I said, nope. Not really that interested. And he went, what? He said, well, the next thing you're going to tell me is that you're voting for Obama, because if you vote for Obama, I'm going to really have to start praying for you. And I said, I'm going to vote for who I want to vote for. I didn't tell him who I was voting for one way or another. That led into a very vibrant discussion about what is important in life and what is the real engine of change in our lives. That's a whole other discussion. But getting back to politics, as I listened to the guys, I was reflecting back on my journey in my effort to break out of kind of a tribalistic mindset and to force myself to think of politics in a cross-cultural way. One of the great benefits for growing up in a foreign country, especially if you've got the right parents, is the ability to see another culture and the ways that that culture goes about answering basic questions of human existence. The Filipinos, when I was there, had some very interesting ways of handling the questions of human existence. They were fundamentally and profoundly different than ours. Just to give you a couple of quick examples, the Filipinos, when I was there, had very much of a communal mindset. They were closer to the land, and they looked at everybody's resources as all of our resources. So if you went into a Filipino's house and you said, wow, that's a really nice vase you have, they would just give it to you. And they would expect to be able to come into your house and compliment you on something, and that you would just give that to them. The Filipinos also are much more personality-oriented than they are principle-oriented. So they have a constitution, but you know, if the president's in and he wants to do something, he just goes ahead and does it. And people don't really spend a lot of time getting upset about that stuff, unless it's not their guy. Now, if it's not their guy, then, you know, big tamasha. But if it's their guy, you know, well, they're much more concerned about the personality than they are the principle. In the Philippines, at least when I was there, the Roman Catholics had been there for hundreds of years. And this, I don't know if it came from the Roman Catholic Church or it just was inherent bad, yay, got it, inherent with the Filipinos, but they really didn't believe something was wrong until you got caught. So, growing up in the Philippines, I had a chance to watch this close up. And I also had parents who did not immediately dismiss those mindsets as not quite measuring up to the standard of the American mindset. And I got a chance to observe Americans who came over and were frankly just obnoxious to the Filipinos. And while there's some things that I wouldn't personally live according to the way that some of the Filipinos lived when I was there, in terms of the decisions and choices they made in life, the fact was I could understand them. I could understand the mindset. And some of the mindset, I could actually see how it might be beneficial. The communal mindset leads you away from selfishness. Filipinos, when I was there, used to have fiesta every year. And it was like this giant community open house where everybody would prepare food and you would just walk from house to house and visit with people. People would save up all year, go in debt for fiesta, put on these lavish spreads. But it was a communal relationship event. We could do with a few of those in America. So I have had the good fortune of growing up in an environment where things were very different than my primary culture in terms of basic ways of relating to each other. And hopefully that's given me the ability to sort of look across the aisle politically and say, okay. As I was talking to my buddies, who are all white boys, and they asked my opinion of some things, it was interesting because the questions themselves were very much geared towards the white boy, rugged individualism mentality, which America was founded on, rugged individualism. You know, well, don't you think that people, if they're going to eat, they need to work? You know, don't you think that people should make an effort and they should pay their bills? And, you know, I don't understand people that just expect the government to give them a handout and take care of them because, you know, my parents worked hard and all of that's true and it's good. It's good to work hard. It's good. But they just couldn't believe that in their minds, that more people were concerned about what will the government do for me, and that tailored their voting pattern more than, you know, just saying, look, just get out of our way and let us do this and don't regulate us so much and we'll be okay. And as I've been thinking about this whole thing, and I've been thinking about the years that have gone by and my own sort of political mindset and my effort to kind of free myself from this tribalism mindset where anybody who doesn't believe like I believe, you know, that's not helpful. It's just not helpful. I've really sort of looked at them and this is what I tried to express to the guys yesterday. I said, first of all, you know, I think the first thing we need to recognize is that we are white boys. And we are white boys that have had a tremendous amount of opportunity. Just a second, I'm checking for mail. I didn't think it would be here this early, but I thought I'd check it. We are white boys that have had a tremendous amount of opportunity. And of course, they responded, well, this is a land of opportunity. Everybody has opportunity. I said, well, wait. We were raised a certain way. You know, we were raised with the idea that America is the land of opportunity, and that it's partly your responsibility to go out and to work hard and take advantage of the opportunities and make something of yourself, that you have that capability because others before you have done it. Sure, they've had setbacks, but they got in and they worked hard. And one of my buddies there, I'm backing into my garage, said, yeah. And he said, my parents, when I was growing up, he said, they lost their farm. They were hard workers. They lost their farm. And they didn't declare bankruptcy because they didn't believe somebody should walk away from their debts. And so they worked hard and worked hard and worked hard to pay off their debts. And he said, I can remember a lot of days when we would eat cereal in the morning and cereal for lunch and cereal at nights because that's all we could afford. And I said, I understand that completely. I understand what you're saying. But there is no question in my mind that I have been blessed in my existence. First of all, I grew up in a two-parent home where my parents loved each other and they loved me and they were clean and sober. That's a huge benefit. Second of all, I was able to grow up in a cross-cultural environment where I had the wonderful experience of being exposed to other cultures. I came back to the States. My parents had prepared a college fund for me so that for most of my time while I was in college, I didn't have to work. And even when I did have to work, I didn't have to work that long and that hard to get myself through college. Fact is, I'm tall and I'm white. And that in itself lends some credences to what I say, you know, people in general trust me more. I mean, there's all these things that flow out of being a white boy in America. There just is. And as I chatted with them about that, I said, conversely, I said, we have other cultural mindsets in America. The Latinos that are coming up from Mexico, they have a mindset that is somewhat similar to the Filipinos in terms of the communal idea and those types of things. And that goes at things a whole lot differently. It's not to say that the Latinos that are coming into the country are not hard workers, because they are. But when they look at what they would term opulence of even the middle class in America, they're not really so sure why they shouldn't get some of those benefits. I was watching one program years ago where they were saying, yeah, as far as the Latinos coming across the border, they feel like if they make it across the border, they've won. They're in. They don't get this idea of deportation. It's like, hey, I'm in America. I get to enjoy these benefits now. And we have a whole other segment of the population that unfortunately grows up in broken homes, grows up in very poor conditions, and poor is not fatal mentally, but when you don't have proper nutrition, you're not going to a school that does anything to inspire you, when for many, they have parents that are involved in the drug trade, and the only people they see that are successful are the ones who are in gangs or on the corner selling drugs in their immediate environment. That's really tough, especially if they've grown up in homes where there has been some measure of welfare taken to keep the family going, because that's like magic. You know, money just shows up. Food stamps just show up every month. Well, I don't have to do anything. And I think it would be very hard to grow up in that environment and not just adopt that environment and adopt those mindsets. Especially when you're looking on TV and you're seeing all these white boys that are so successful and you're thinking, well, I could, you know, I'm smart enough to do some of that stuff and I just don't have an opportunity. And so you end up with people living in the same country that have completely different ideas about what the country is and completely different ideas about what the role of government should be and what the role of business should be. And obviously, from a democratic standpoint, the solution for the poor and underprivileged and the inequities in our society is for the government to do something. The solution for the Republicans is for us just to get away out of the way of businesses so businesses can prosper, because then that will mean people can go into businesses and get jobs and they can prosper. But I don't think either of those things ultimately is a solution, and here's why. We overlook the fundamental fact that before people can be a success externally, they have to be a success internally. And there are white people and African American people and Latino people and Asian American people, a whole variety of people, for various reasons, who are not successful internally yet. And if we take care of that, the rest of it will flow. And what you see in success stories of peoples who are coming out of the ghettos is that you see there was someone in their life who inspired them. Because we always learn discipline from other people. There was someone who took them under a wing and mentored them and helped them believe that they could do better. And for many Asian Americans, that's their family group. And that's why they're so successful. For many white boys and white girls, it's their family group, and that's why it's so successful. But for people who don't have that family structure, you know, who don't have that discipline in the home, who don't have that discipline for their caregivers, unless we can get mentors, unless we can get individual-to-individual contact, and training and teaching and helping, it doesn't matter how much money the government gives them, nor does it matter how many opportunities they have to get a job, because they won't have a work ethic. So in my mind, the solution isn't the government just handing out more money. The solution really isn't just getting out of the way so that businesses can prosper and employ people. Because I think if 2008 proved anything to us, it proved that if we just let the financiers run rampant and do whatever they want, they're going to run this country right into the ground. So I think we do need a balance between government and business, but I think the primary solution for our country is not government, and it's not business, and it's not education, and it's not entertainment. It is person-to-person contact, where mentors can reach those who never had the opportunity to understand that they have the tool sets of success. They just have to harness them. But to come to that understanding will take time. It will take relationship, a lot of love, and the teaching of a lot of discipline. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it home.